To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. Preemptive detention? A Kafkaesque story of a human rights lawyer from Ciudad Juarez. He says he fears for his life in Mexico, but he's not asking for asylum, but he's detained anyway.
What's important is that the practices and this treatment of migrants, of people who arrive with all the proper documents, their visas, their passports, people who work or just come to visit for a few days, should not be mistreated in the manner that I was. Because if you ask anyone coming from Ciudad Juarez these days, are you scared? Well, everyone is going to say yes. But you can't just throw everyone into jail, right?
On today's program, what's the real lesson of the detention of human rights lawyer Gustavo de la Rosa Hickerson? That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Here now to discuss the news of the week is Pilar Marrero, political columnist and reporter for La Opinión, the Spanish-language daily newspaper based in Los Angeles. Good to talk to you, Pilar.
Hi, Maria. It's great to be here.
We've seen in the Virginia Senate race that President Obama has some coattails there, but he's also getting a lot of criticism about coat dragging on a number of issues important to Latinos in the state of Virginia. But is there a sense that the Latino Virginia electorate is getting a little impatient with President Obama and the fact that there's no movement on issues like immigration, healthcare, education, and other domestic issues?
And I think it's not only in Virginia. Obviously, people are nervous across the country with what is going on. We hear the recession. It's over, but we keep hearing people, you know, losing their jobs. Right now, working on a story about credit scores and credit reports, and they're really going down the drain. People are in real trouble trying to modify their mortgages. So, yeah, there's a lot of impatience in the Latino community right now. They're still waiting for immigration reform. They're still waiting for healthcare reform, and they see very little movement in the economy. So in general, I think this is going to start really affecting Democrats politically if they don't show any results pretty soon.
All right, let's turn now to the census, a highly political issue. A lot of people don't know this, but right now there's at least one bill in the House that would require the census to count only citizens, and that's where the controversy stems from. If you have, let's say, 12 million people living in this country without papers, should they be counted or not? So what's going on with this story?
Well, it's a senator, a Republican senator called Vitter. He introduced basically an amendment in a spending bill that says that they won't give any money to the census if there is not a specific reform that says that they won't count people who are not citizens. Now, this is an incredibly strange thing because the census historically has always tried to count as many people as possible to have an accurate count of how many people live in the country for many, many reasons. And now the immigration issue is going as far as affecting the issue of the census. Now, that probably won't get through the Democratic Congress, but it's just an example of how it invades all issues, including healthcare reform, which I know we'll talk about next. But, you know, there's also groups in the Latino community that are asking for a boycott of the census by immigrants and by Latinos to push the administration for immigration reform. So everything now has been infected by the immigration issue, and it's been affected by the fact that people are impatient with this government, and they want to see them move on different issues.
All right, and finally, in terms of healthcare reform, what is there, any plan at all that has any chance that would give any coverage to 12 million people, undocumented immigrants or legal immigrants, for healthcare? What is the status of undocumented immigrants or legal immigrants and their coverage under any healthcare reform?
Well, right now, undocumented immigrants are not covered by any of the bills. There was a whole discussion over whether they would be able to buy into the pool that would be available for people to buy private insurance. Some of this pool will be subsidized, so there was a big fight over whether they were going to get subsidies. The Obama administration has said they will not get subsidies and they will not be covered, which makes you think about what the effectiveness of a health care reform that doesn't cover 12 million people or more that are in this country will be in lowering costs. At the same time, legal residents cannot get any public help for 5 years after they become legal residents, and they won't be covered also. So, you know, these are issues to be thinking about, and there are, again, immigration and the problems with immigration keep coming up in every public issue right now. But, you know, the real problem is, will it work if you don't cover so many millions of people who are in this country using the emergency rooms, and the community clinics are closing down and cutting their availability because they're getting cut by the states. So it's not clear how much we're going to get out of this reform if we don't cover everyone.
Thanks, Pilar, for bringing us that update.
Oh, you're welcome.
Pilar Marrero is a political writer and reporter for La Opinión, the Spanish-language daily newspaper based in Los Angeles. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Every day, thousands of individuals are detained by immigration officials. But earlier this month, the detention of one person crossing the border from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, into El Paso, Texas, caused many people to take notice. His name is Gustavo de la Rosa Hickerson. And although he was not requesting amnesty in this country, he had expressed a fear for his life back home. So border officials said they were obligated to detain the renowned human rights attorney. De La Rosa Hickerson has been released, but his case raises many questions. From El Paso, Texas, Monica Ortiz Uribe has our story.
The day after Gustavo De La Rosa Hickerson was released from an immigration detention center in El Paso, he and his attorney hosted a well-attended press conference. De La Rosa's case has been publicly exposed since late September, when he announced he was receiving death threats, which he attributes to the Mexican military. All the media buzz seems to have worked in De La Rosa's favor. Carlos Spector is De La Rosa's lawyer.
Well, we were able to successfully release Gustavo De La Rosa from custody, and his border crossing card has been returned. And no charges were filed, so he's back to square one.
On October 15th, customs agents at the port of entry pulled De La Rosa aside for questioning when he attempted to cross legally into El Paso with his tourist visa or border crossing card.
Paso a revisión secundaria y entonces me empiezan a preguntar.
De La Rosa explained that although he was afraid of being in Juarez, he was not coming to the United States to seek asylum. The Mexican government recently provided him with bodyguards. Nevertheless, after hours of questioning, he was taken to an immigration detention facility where he remained for 6 days. Roger Meyer is the El Paso spokesman for U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
At any point, if someone expresses a fear for their safety, a concern for their livelihood in the country from which they're departing and entering the U.S., that sets in series some events that we do have to follow.
Although he's not authorized to speak about individual cases, Meyer explained it is policy to refer a foreign national who expresses fear of returning to his country to another agency within the Department of Homeland Security who can discuss the possibility of asylum. That person is then detained for at least 48 hours until an asylum interview is scheduled. Carlos Spector, De La Rosa's lawyer, argues that even under DHS policy, his client should have never been detained.
But once someone in unequivocal terms says, I do not want asylum, the interview is over. And in our estimation, any further detention would be unlawful.
On October 21st, De La Rosa was released after he again rejected asylum proceedings with a DHS representative. Upon his release, De La Rosa said he refused to sign a document that would have resulted in his deportation as a result of his asylum rejection. He argues that he didn't cross into the United States seeking asylum in the first place, so he shouldn't face any more consequences for rejecting it. Spector believes De La Rosa's case is significant because of the incredible violence and insecurity that exist in Juarez and other parts of Mexico.
For anybody who lives on the border knows, anyone that comes from Juarez to El Paso can and does express a fear of returning to Mexico because of the situation, but it doesn't necessarily mean they want asylum.
Spector is currently gathering support from local and national human rights organizations to petition for a congressional inquiry into De La Rosa's case. De La Rosa will continue to travel to and from the United States and to do his work as a human rights defender. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso.
I'm joined now by Gustavo De La Rosa Hickerson. He's joining us from El Paso, Texas. Welcome to Latino USA, Gustavo. Bienvenido al programa.
Gracias.
Gustavo, what exactly happened on October 15th? You were trying to get into El Paso, Texas. Where were you coming from, and what exactly happened at that moment?
Mire, yo venía de Guadalajara.
Well, I was flying from Guadalajara to Juarez, and I was supposed to be picked up at the airport by two bodyguards that the government had assigned to me. I noticed that one of the bodyguards was different, so I asked them, what happened to the original bodyguard? And they told me he had been killed a few days earlier. I didn't know the reason, but it made me very nervous and scared. So I decided to go to El Paso for a few days and sort out what happened to my bodyguard.
At that moment, when you are now in detention, what was going on in your mind at that moment?
Yo pensaba que una vez que terminara el interrogatorio, pues
I thought that once the interrogation was done, they would let me go on my way to El Paso. And that was even the indication I got from the agent who was interviewing me. He told me clearly that I had not violated any laws. And then the supervisor of the agent came in and said they were going to detain me in order to protect me.
Did you think, okay, they are going to take me to a safe house and I am going to be put into some kind of, anonymous but small house somewhere? Or did you think, okay, I'm about to go into a detention center?
No, yo cuando él me dijo que me estaban deteniendo para...
When they told me I was going into protective custody, I was very cooperative and they put me in a vehicle to transport me. And before I knew it, we were at a prison. That's when I started to get worried. Later, when I was in the jail, they asked if I wanted to be placed among the general population, where there were gang members and other delinquents, or to be placed in a maximum security unit. So, of course, I told him I wanted to be in the maximum security unit. But once I was in the unit, I had to follow all the rules as the other prisoners, where you're locked down for 22 hours, you're allowed to go out for 1 hour in an enclosed patio, you get 1 hour of TV a day.
Con techo y encerrado totalmente, un pequeño patio, y les dan una hora de televisión.
So you're a human rights lawyer. You have now expressed fear. You're not asking for asylum. You're now a prisoner. You're being walked around with handcuffs on your hands and your feet. What's going on for you as a human rights lawyer? I mean, are you thinking this is just the most Kafkaesque scenario that you could ever imagine?
No me explico por qué no han diseñado espacios para tener a las personas.
I can't figure out why they haven't created spaces to place people who are looking for asylum. It seems that the only place that they can come up with is to stick them in prison and to treat them like criminals. But you know, I am a lawyer with 37 years of experience. And there is one thing that I know for certain. All around the world, it is recognized that you can't just detain someone who has not broken a law. And when you arrest someone, you have to tell him or her what law has been broken.
So, Gustavo De La Rosa, are you thinking that you have a violation of international law in terms of everything that went down with your detention?
Estoy preocupado y pensando.
No, I am concerned, and I have been thinking about what I can do to end these types of abuses. So what I have been thinking about is asking for an investigation, like a congressional investigation. But really, that is not the most important thing. What's important is that the practices and this treatment of migrants, of people who arrive with all the proper documents, their visas, their passports, should not be mistreated in the manner that I was. Because if you ask anyone coming from Ciudad Juarez these days, are you scared? Well, everyone is going to say yes. But you can't just throw everyone into jail, right?
Toda la gente de Juarez tiene miedo y no los van a meter a la cárcel a todos porque tienen miedo, ¿no?
Gustavo, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and good luck.
Gracias.
Gustavo de la Rosa Hickerson is an attorney based in Juarez, Mexico. And now, from StoryCorps, dos historias. First, two brothers' childhood memorias. Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, and his brother, Colorado Congressman John Salazar, both got their start in Colorado. And here, they remember about how their success in politics began.
I think one of the best things that's happened since we both came to Washington in 2004 was coming back here with Mom for the swearing-in ceremony where you were sworn into the U.S. House of Representatives. Because if you think about how we grew up, as poor as we were, I know that Dad and Mom were always really proud of the fact that all eight of their kids became first-generation college graduates. And I think that we grew up so close together. You know, we did everything together. We made our own carretas, our toys, wheelbarrows, because we couldn't afford to buy toys. And you remember those days. We couldn't afford a bike. And so we'd spend our time doing whatever we could.
Right. I went to school with one shoe, one kind of one or the other. You remember that? Leroy would wear out his right shoe and I'd wear out my left shoe. And so I would get Leroy's hand-me-downs because Dad could only afford one pair of shoes. And I remember walking to school and my left foot was like size 10 and my right foot was only a size 5. That was so embarrassing, but I thank God that we had to go through stuff like that.
Like the Salazars, Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona found political success close to home. He sat down with his daughter, Marisa, who interviewed him about growing up in Tucson.
What are your memories of growing up in Nanandata's house?
I was the only boy. I mean, I'm a mama's boy, and I'm not ashamed of it. But school was always a friction point with my mother.
But you liked school, didn't you?
I loved it. I was a schoolboy, but I didn't like her to press me on it all the time.
How did she feel about report cards?
She didn't speak English, but she understood A and only looked for A's and B's. Anything less than that would mean you'd be studying for the rest of your life. So you'd kind of strive to get those two. And I remember getting an award. I think it was 7th or 8th grade. I was one of four students in the whole class that was getting an award. And they said, make sure you invite your parents. And I didn't tell my mom. I felt embarrassed of her because she couldn't speak English. And all the other parents could. Pasaron como tres meses. I mean, it's been 3 months. This award ceremony's over. And then I remember my mom telling me, ¿cómo te fue el premio? And I went, whoa, she knew. But that's all she said. Then a couple of days later, I'm getting ready in front of the mirror. And she goes, mira, mijito, no te olvides que naciste con un nopal en la frente. Don't forget, you were born with a nopal on your forehead, and that's you, and you should never be embarrassed about it. That changed me a lot. I started to become more conscious of how people treated people. I started to become more conscious of a lot of political issues. And so even in that sense, you know, your parents have an influence on you in an interesting way.
If you'd like to participate in the StoryCorps Historias project, go to our website at latinousa.org. And in a minute, Peloteros en el Barrio, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jesse Katz, coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision. and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Imagine for a moment that you're playing in a baseball game and you're coming up to bat. Well, I can't imagine because I've never really played a lot of baseball, but let's go with it. So there's a runner on first base. There's less than two outs and your team is either one run down or tied. So what do you do? Do you swing for the fences? Do you attempt to bend the game to your will by trying to pull the ball into the stands? Or do you give yourself up for the team, for the game, and take the ball to the opposite field? If you're a team player and understand how to play the game, that's exactly what you do. Going opposite field, while sounding contrarian, is actually the essence of cooperation and teamwork. As Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Jesse Katz writes in his new memoir, The Opposite Field, to go the other way, he says, is to choose contact over power. It means sacrificing ego, holding back, adjusting. Jesse Katz joins me now on Latino USA. Welcome to our program, Jesse.
It's great to be here, Maria.
So you decide to title your book, The Opposite Field. Tell us why. Why the importance of the opposite field and what it meant for you to go to the opposite field?
I think what the opposite field represents in terms of a metaphor is some of the unconventional choices that I've made in my life, the kind of work that I've done and whom I've chosen to love have all been sort of challenging situations and in some cases hazardous situations. Kind of one of the underlying themes of my life and of this book is that effort to adapt to and connect with those experiences on the other side of the border, across the divide.
I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading from your prologue, actually, where it says the cliche of Little League.
All right, gladly. The cliche of Little League, of youth sports in America, is one of lost perspective. By taking it too seriously, adults have ruined a children's game. I've begun to think that the opposite is true, that we do not take it seriously enough. Nothing in my 40-plus years has compared with the enormity, with the complexities or the sensitivities of trying to keep La Loma afloat.
So basically what happens is that you're in Monterey Park and your son's Little League team basically is falling apart. And so are you like a guy who's like Mr. Baseball Man? Because suddenly you become like the commissioner down there. So was this like a natural for you to suddenly be inserted into this basically field where you've got a lot of Asian players, a lot of Mexican players, and your son who's half Nicaraguan, half Jewish, LA, you know, kind of Southern California. So was that a natural for you?
You know, with all things, there's an external motivation and there's an internal motivation. And the external thing was, it was more than just my son's team. It was an entire league that was falling apart. And we were really facing the possibility of missing out on a baseball season. And I felt that I had the ability to step in and make a difference in that regard. But you know, our internal motivations are always more complex and sometimes selfish. And, you know, one of the things that was going on in my life was I had developed a very complicated personal and family life as part of this large extended family of Nicaraguans. And my marriage had just begun to crumble at that time. I was having trouble with a stepson who was flirting with gangster life. And baseball became a way for me to build a connection with my son, Max, that was going to survive whatever tumult lay out there. I think by becoming the commish, I was protecting my son. And on some level, I was also making amends for the other son, for the stepson that I was unable to reach.
You also talk about your own family history, which is fascinating, because your mom, for example, she had to escape as a Jew from Europe. She and your dad ended up in Portland, Oregon, and you're an only child, and you're growing up in the United States as basically, you know, first generation. Your mom and dad did not get your love of baseball, but your mom becomes the mayor of Portland. But as she's kind of taking off, you are too, and you decide to immerse yourself in this life of the streets of L.A., the gangs, reporting on all this. So how do you see those two things together? You know, this whole experience of kind of your this immigrant background, and then you end up leaving what could have been a fine life in Portland to kind of go into the depths of some dark sides there in L.A.
At first, I thought I was kind of rebelling against my parents and, you know, rebelling against what my natural culture or background might be. But the more I began to examine where I come from, where my parents come from, the more I began to see that I wasn't really breaking a cycle, but in a lot of significant ways, I was repeating it. You know, the story of my parents, the story of Jews in this world is one of, you know, persecution and immigration and assimilation. You know, that's also the story of Latinos in the United States. And really, it's an American story that belongs to all of us.
You describe something a kind of like this communal reawakening, this retro assimilation that's taking place in the area around La Loma. So in the end, uplifting, hopeful, or got a lot more work to do?
Oh, does it have to be one or the other? I mean, it's both. It's all of the above. I mean, look, where I live, you know, I'm smack in the middle of sort of the classic, you know, Mexican-American where I live, you know, dilemma of not being, you know, American enough to sort of make it in the mainstream and yet not being Latino enough to, you know, be fully considered part of Mexican culture. And I think what's taken place both in the community I live and in Los Angeles more generally, and I think to some degree in the rest of the country, is all of those dividing lines have begun to shift and melt. So I think a lot of people that felt caught in the middle and maybe were, you know, not sure of what was the proper way to identify themselves and whether that identity was going to lead to success are beginning to see that, in fact, this mixing and these syntheses and that's a beautiful thing, and that is at the essence of the Latino experience in America. And, you know, I feel fortunate that I was able to have a little part of that.
Jesse Katz is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner and a former staffer at the Los Angeles Times and Los Angeles Magazine. He lives with his son Max in Monterey Park, California. His memoir, titled The Opposite Field, is published by Crown, a division of Random House. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Beth Warshot Duncan at WXPN and Monica Ortiz Uribe. Our listener comment line is 1-800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
The play starts when the batter hits the ball. Strangely enough, however, the pitcher tries to keep the batter from hitting the ball.
Support for NPR is provided by Lumber Liquidators, hardwood flooring for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD or lumberliquidators.com. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.